Welcome to our show today. We're picking up our Scholar Reviewed, which is going to be the new international commentary of the New Testament. We started a few weeks ago with Matthew 5:17, touched on 18 a little bit. And as that particular scholar was giving his support on why he disagrees with all the other commentaries that support the Torah is in existence until heaven and earth pass away, but he does not support that. That was the question that started this whole journey. Could I review a commentary that did not agree with all the other ones that I read? That was a long list of scholars who agreed that the Torah was still in effect, but it was pretty easy to find a commentary that disagreed. So we've been working through the passages. It's available online in a PDF on my website. I have selected the first three pages, and it is available for you to review, and we read it from time to time. I'm not reading it today because we've read it in the other shows. We're dealing with a passage in Matthew 15, and there is a parallel account of that same story in Mark 7. And so the commentator, what he said was, Mark contradicts himself from Matthew 5:17 to Matthew 15. And that he's saying, if he's saying in Matthew 5:17 that if the law is in effect until heaven and earth pass away, then he contradicts himself, the commentator says, in Matthew 15:1 when he has Yeshua doing away with the food laws. So that is one of his supports. Now, he already did the Romans 14:14 thing, and we shot that down. Then he did the Acts 11 thing, and we shot that down. Then he did the Galatians 5 thing, and we shot that down. So now we're in the Matthew 15 piece, and we've already had a show on Matthew 15. Actually, we've had two shows on Matthew 15. This is the third show on Matthew 15, and we're working our way through it. Now, as we're getting started on this, what I want to bring to your attention, I have offered four questions, of which you can pick one to answer, and I do it at the beginning of each of the broadcasts, just to remind us where we are. Now, we know that the Anointed One who was prophesied to come, that they had a lot of tasks that they would be doing. No questions about that, lots of tasks. So I narrowed it down. Let me tell you in a sentence what that's like. I asked the following question. As regards the Torah, which is the law of God, the primary mission of this Anointed One who was prophesied to come was 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, so that's where we are. So I'm not taking away from all the other things that the Anointed One was going to do and accomplish and etc. I'm focused only on his relationship to the Torah and the law of God. So I say again, here's the questions. As regards the Torah, the law of God, the primary mission of this Anointed One was to do away with the entire law. This was the primary mission of the Anointed One coming to earth, was to do away with the entire law. That is answer number one. Answer number two, as regards the Torah, law of God, the primary mission of this Anointed One was to do away with some of the laws, like maybe the food laws, maybe the Sabbath, maybe the appointed times, you know, the ones that were set up in creation in Genesis 1:14 and detailed later in Leviticus 23. So that's a good group to get rid of. Food laws, Sabbath, the appointed times. So that's the second answer. Didn't come to do away with all the law, just came to do away with some of the law. Three. Or, as regards the Torah, law of God, the primary mission of this Anointed One was to speak the words of God as a prophet to draw people back to the Torah. I go to Deuteronomy 18, 15, and 18 for that, where it says, I will raise up for them a prophet. You know what a prophet does. We already discussed the prophet, the prophetic ministry of Yeshua in this study of Matthew 15 and Mark 7. Call back Israel to better Torah observance. And if you continue with the prophecy in Deuteronomy 18, it says, the Most High will put his words in his mouth, in the Anointed One's mouth, and he will speak them as he is commanded to. And of course, Yeshua speaks to that and says, the words that I speak are not mine, but his who sent me. So that's number three. The primary mission as regards the Torah, the law of God, would be to speak the words of God and call people back to Torah observance. And finally, number four, as regards the Torah law of God, the primary mission of this anointed one was to help untangle the misinterpretations that having the oral traditions added to the written Torah caused. So those are some choices that you get to pick. But whatever choice you pick, that's going to create the filter that you're going to read all the text through. So what we're trying to do is reset that with this study of this section. All right, so we have finished in Matthew 15, we got through verse 9, and in Mark 7, we did verse 13, and this had to do with the prophecy that Isaiah stated in chapter 29, in which these people had moved away from obedience to the Torah using their traditions and taking those and teaching the people the traditions, not teaching the Word of God, teaching the traditions. Isaiah said it a long time ago, hundreds of years before the first century. Now Yeshua, in his prophetic ministry, is reiterating that for the situation at hand. So we're going to pick it up now. We have finished the prophetic statement, and we're moving into the next phase. The next phase is going to be a discussion of ritual and moral impurity. First, what I'd like to do is I'd like to read the text, and we're going to, as I said, we're combining Mark and Matthew together because sometimes each one brings something additional to the text so that we can understand it better. So I have combined them together. So here we go concerning section, I believe this is section 5. Let me take a look. I'm going to scroll back. 1, 2, 3. Nope. This is section 4. Here we go. And when he had called all the people unto him, he said unto them, hearken unto me, every one of you, and understand, there is nothing from outside a man that entering into him, this is through the mouth, eating, can defile him. But the things which come out of him, those are they that defile the man. All right, that statement is going to have to be worked on because it's a little bit involved. And if you remember a couple of shows back, we got into the Mishnah. Talk about getting into the weeds. That was crazy stuff. I just wanted you to be aware from the particular writings of the rabbis as they understood all these different things that related to ritual purity. But here we are again discussing this statement. This statement here is a very strong statement about nothing from outside can defile him. So let's take a look at what that is saying. So here we go. I'm going to read this again, and I'm going to change the English words to Greek in a couple of places. And when he had called the people, he said, hear and understand. There is no food that a person eats that commons them. The Greek word there is the Greek word for common. It's what comes out of them that commons them. So I just want to bring to your attention, that's the Greek word, the same Greek word that's found in Romans 14:14, which we addressed a show or two back to help people understand the role of the conscience, even in a bad tradition. That's what Romans 14:14 addresses. So that same Greek word, is here. And so it is translated as defile, and I'm not saying that that's a bad translation. If you go to 4 Maccabees, I think it's chapter 7, verse 6, in some Greek editions, one of them will have common, and it's clear within the context that it's talking about a certain type of defilement. So I'm not getting on anybody. I'm just letting you know that this is talking about a particular type of defilement, and we'll get into a little bit more detail as we go along, but let's go ahead and tell the story here. In the first parts, as we said, this is part four. In the first parts, he is having a discussion. It appears to be a meal because they're talking about eating bread. And we have some Pharisees and some scribes that came from Jerusalem. You have Yeshua with some of his disciples. I don't know if he had all 12 there. It doesn't say. But at least some of his disciples were there. So we had a small little group there that would gather together for something to eat. I don't know if it was a full meal because they only mentioned bread, but you know, whatever. It was at least a contained situation. But now We're changing that because Yeshua has already spoke to them. Apparently, there were people who were not part of the eating party who overheard some things and did not understand what Yeshua was saying. And that's why you get in verse 14 of Mark 7, and when he had called all the people unto himself, he said unto them, hearken unto me and understand. So we get this same thing in Matthew 5:17. Do not think that I have come. What is that saying? That means that somebody was thinking some thoughts, and those thoughts contain the concept of Yeshua was going to lessen the requirements of Torah. But he says, no, do not think that I have come to lessen the requirements of the Torah. Eventually, what he's going to sort out is that, but not in Matthew 5:17, is going to be, I'm going to untangle the oral tradition with the written Torah so that we can get these things straightened out. And here we have that same situation. We have an oral tradition that is outside of Torah. So why is his disciples not keeping the tradition of the elders? Because it's not valid as far as Torah observance is concerned. That's why they're not keeping it. Oh, but I think that was a spoiler. I should have given you a spoiler alert. Anyway, let's continue. There's no food that a person eats that defiles them. It's what comes out of them that defiles them. So this is the big statement. This is a statement we're going to understand in great detail. But first, let me finish this little section. Then the disciples came unto him and said, are you aware that the Pharisees were offended? And then Yeshua says, I am so sorry. I will shut my mouth and go sit over there in the corner. What? I hear you say. Your English Bible does not have that statement of Yeshua? Well, that's because it never happened. Yeah. He never apologized to the Pharisees for offending them. You might want to stick that one in your cap, put it on the back burner. As a matter of fact, he followed up the offending statement with something very interesting. Let's take a look at it. He answered and said, every plant which my heavenly Father has not planted shall be rooted up. What does that mean? We'll discuss it. And then he follows with another verse. Just leave them alone. They are blind leaders of the blind, and if the blind lead the blind, both will fall into a ditch. By the way, concept of blind in what we're talking about can be found in Isaiah 29:9, which we had already discussed in the previous show. All right, a lot to unpack here, so let's get started. There's something about ritual purity, and I know that there have been some commentators who have felt like Yeshua came against the ritual impurity, and by default, the food laws, clean and unclean, that whole thing, by making this statement. But that's not the reality, and so what we're going to do is we're going to figure that out. Their argument rests on the assumption that his view of ritual purity differed from the Torah's. In other words, the view that ritual impurity leads to internal or moral defilement. Yeshua did not teach that. The Torah does not teach that. But there are sects of Judaism in the first century that do teach that. So, in a manner of speaking, you could say they have given improper weight to priorities that don't really exist. So we're not even talking about reality here. Reality in their head, that's Romans 14:14. Maybe I mention that again just for clarity. But the Torah doesn't teach that. So this is the situation. There is a ritual impurity in the Torah, but is clearly distinguished from a moral impurity. And there's no relationship between the two. Now let me explain that a little bit. Ritual impurity, which is a state that is important when you're dealing with the temple and the things that are holy and etc., those type of things, that is a real thing. But it always pointed to something else, something greater. Ritual impurity pointed to moral impurity. But they didn't have a relationship. It was just a type. Just as aspects of the temple point to the work of Yeshua. Exodus 25, 9 and 40, do it, build it according to the pattern, tells us that there were things that were pointing that way. If you look at Colossians 2, 16 and 17, it will say the festival, new moons, and Sabbaths foreshadow things to come. And for those of you who are reading it in the NIV, the editorial committee wanted to not put what the Greek text says, so the verb in Greek, which was in present tense, they translated into past tense. They didn't put an asterisk, they didn't put a footnote, and they didn't put an italic. So theirs reads something like, the festivals, new moons, and Sabbaths, which are a shadow of things that were to come. That way, the English readers who pick up their Bible will read that and say, oh yeah, the festival, new moons, and Sabbaths were a shadow, but not anymore, because that's in the past. But the Greek verb is present. That means that Paul, writing this letter 30 years after the resurrection and the ascension, is still using the present tense to make the case that these are types and the entire plan of redemption has not played itself out yet. And there's multiple examples of this. I'm not going to go into all of them. That's just one, just to give you a taste of what we're up against. Editorial committees that just translate it based on their own personal doctrinal beliefs and leave the underlying Greek text behind. But anyway, we are here discussing that ritual impurity is a thing, but it does not have a relationship with moral impurity. It points to it, but it doesn't have a relationship directly. So, I want to talk about ritual impurity so you can see where it fits into the system of life. It was regarded as natural, unavoidable, and sometimes there was no choice. For example, women have a time of the month, approximately a week. It occurs usually every month. During that time, they are ritually unclean. There's also genital discharges, giving birth to a child. You are ritually unclean. Contracting a disease, you, depending on the disease, you may become ritually unclean. Burying one's dead results in ritual impurity. What about the man who takes the goat too in Leviticus 16:21 out into the wilderness? When they return, they are ritually unclean. There are a multitude, can I use the word plethora? There's a plethora of actions that result in ritual impurity. There is no sin specifically involved in those things, and I think that that is very important. Nothing is inherently sinful in becoming ritually impure with that list, that short list that I just gave you. So there's no connection there with moral impurity. The system was about an individual and their relationship to the sacred, and not about the individual's moral status. And that's very important to understand that, because moral impurity does exist as well. But what I am stating is that ritual impurity, moral impurity, let's make sure that we keep the line of demarcation in place. Now, there are different sects of Judaism in the first century, and the first one I want to mention, and this is during the Second Temple period, I might add, is the community where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And in their writings, their understanding, their interpretation, their traditions are a complete identification existed between ritual and moral impurity. I have that quote. So this means that for them, ritual impurity has to be combated at the highest level because it's equal to being morally impure. That's how they understood it. That's not on point. Let me just say it's not on point. Now, on the other hand, on the other end of the spectrum, you've got the leaders of the later sect of Judaism known as Rabbinic Judaism. It was most of the people in the Pharisaic sect came to be known as the rabbinic Judaism. That was the form, that was the sect. And a lot, they drew in a lot of the other groups. They did not draw in Yeshuic Judaism, which was a separate sect in the first century and on onward centuries. So toward the end of the first century, you have two sects of Judaism for the most part. You have rabbinic Judaism and you have Yeshuic Judaism. So in rabbinic Judaism, they're the other way, ritual and moral impurity. They don't even say the two in the same sentence. There was a massive emphasis placed on ritual purity issues, and they shifted everything from the focus of the temple to the focus of your table. So in other words, the house, as I told you a couple shows back, the house is the temple, your table, the altar, food, sacrifice. Of course, you need to eat sacrifices. Consider the Levites. They had to eat in a ritually pure state. The sacrifices brought by the people at the temple, sacrificed on the altar. So if you extend that requirement, which Torah doesn't do, but if you extend it to the people, then they have to do the hand washing ceremony to be ritually pure before they partake of anything to eat. That's not on point. So that's a problem. So this is where Yeshua finds himself. You have these types of things going on. Philo has his own opinion as well, and he will mention some things about some distinction, but some relationship. So when I opened this presentation right at the beginning, when we started, the question that I asked was, what was the role of the teaching of Yeshua in this Matthew 15, Mark 7 event? What was the role of the teaching? One of the things was to straighten out misunderstandings concerning ritual purity. And we will pick this up on the other side of the half hour when we come back for our second segment. Thank you. Welcome back to our show. On the other side of the half hour, we're going to continue our discussion with ritual purity, ritual impurity, and its counterpoint on the moral side. What we've talked about is that within the context of the situation, we have Dead Sea Scroll people who have an extreme idea about this. We have what the Pharisees think about it, and a number of other things that fit into that. So Yeshua's set down right in the middle, and what he's going to do, and think about this, not only is he coming to unravel traditions that have been incorporated into the Torah, and we saw that with Peter in Acts 10 when he gets to Cornelius' house and says, you know, it's against the law for me to be here. No, it's not. It's against oral tradition for you to be here. So he sorted that out. But in other areas, he corrected, just as we stated, and which I'll go ahead and read this again, the Genesis Rabbah, the understanding of what the rabbis had as regards the role of the Anointed One when he comes. I'm taking this quote from Genesis Rabbah 99:8, and then I'm going to read you the footnotes that are in the Sassino edition. And here it goes. He washes his garments in wine, that's the Torah. It states, intimates that the Messiah will compose for them words of Torah. And then the second part from the Torah in Genesis 49 is, and his vesture in the blood of grapes, that he will restore to them their eras. Now, if you read the footnotes in this Jewish edition, they say, propound new meanings and interpretations of the Torah. And the second footnote, which is the key footnote for us, is he will point out where they have misunderstood the Torah. So what that means is one of the expectations of Pharisaic Judaism is that when the Anointed One would come, he would sort out things that they don't have on point. And this tradition, as regards extending the priestly function to the house of ordinary individuals, is not valid. You are overextending. It becomes a heavy yoke. Does that ring a bell? My yoke is light. Yeah, because he only is telling people to do Torah. Don't do all this other stuff. Stay with what your Heavenly Father instructs you to do. That's what your responsibility is. So he sorts those things out. Now, one of the things that we have to ask whenever we're doing these studies within the context is that, how did Yeshua do as far as fitting within the boundaries of Second Temple Judaism in the first century? So if you look at the things that he's going to say there, it's like, is this really true? Can we really go this far? We'll get there. All right, so let me continue with that discussion. He is going to try to bring a balance. You look at the Pharisees, they're concerned with hand washing, but they're indifferent to the needs of their parents. That's just not right. So he's going to say that moral purity is more important than ritual purity and demands greater attention. If you go and look at Torah, and this would probably be mostly in Leviticus, you will see that by definition, by what the Most High has designated, certain things are clean to be consumed, and they are defined as food. So if I was to refer to the other white meat, pork, that's not food. You can eat it, but it's not food. That which is defined as food in Torah are those things which you are authorized to eat, are declared clean by the Most High. So he's talking here about food, but he is mixing two things together. Going back to verse 15, nothing outside. So in talking about the items that you would consume, that entering into him, you eat them, can morally defile him. They don't morally defile you. Then he finishes, but the things which come out of him, they are the things that defile the man. That is true both ritually and morally. So that allows for an expanded understanding that if you are staying with the food, which of course is the things that are clean, then when you eat them, there is not going to be any ritual defilement. But if you go back to the discussion about what took place at the beginning of the story, the Pharisees, thinking that you had to extend temple practice of the priest to the home of non-temple people, they are saying that they don't wash their hands, so that means that their hands are common or defiled. Common is the word that's in the Greek. So why don't they wash their hands? Because the Pharisees feel that the bread, yes, the bread is clean. It's been designated clean. But if somebody with defiled hands touches it, the bread is not clean anymore and I can't eat it. And that's what Paul is addressing in Romans 14:14. Nothing is common or defiled of its own. Common of the food groups, none of it's common. But if an individual who wants to eat thinks it has become defiled or common, then to him it is defiled or common. And as 23, verse 23 in Romans 14 states, if he eats it, that's evil. Because he knows that he's doing something his conscience is telling him he can't do. Even though the tradition is an error and does not exist in our reality, that's not the point that Paul is making. It's the conscience of the individual. So, taking it back now to Matthew 15 and Mark 7, the situation is, what if the disciples touch the bread? I'm hungry. And if they touch the bread, it becomes common or defiled, and I can't eat it. Wrong. Because that which you have created in your oral tradition doesn't really exist at all. So that's why Yeshua is getting on them. He is straightening out oral traditions that are invalid. There were other traditions that were invalid. You'll notice places where it says that after the Sabbath ended, people would bring out their sick and whatever, and then Yeshua would heal them. But it took place after the Sabbath ended. Why? Because there was an oral tradition that you couldn't heal during the Sabbath day. And he actually got called out. They found fault with some of his actions when he healed somebody during the Sabbath. So he had to reply to that, and he gave an example. So that's just one other example where he had to correct an imbalance. They had taken the Sabbath restriction too far. You can do good on the Sabbath. And he healed somebody, and that was good. And it took place on the Sabbath. So here we are again with something that's not really a reality, except for the conscience of the individual. So notwithstanding what Paul says in Romans 14:14, these gentlemen believe that if the disciples touch that bread with unwashed hands, because they haven't done the ceremony of hand washing, then they will transfer ritual impurity to the bread, and now the rest of the Pharisees, they can't eat. And that's what I was reading in one of my quotes. It says that a lot of times, unless they wash, they can't eat. So by pulling down the additional restrictions on the priests eating the sacrifices at the temple brought by the people and putting it on the regular people, no, that is just a problem. It's a heavy yoke, and we don't want it, and we need to get rid of it. So as you can see from this particular passage, right before this, there was a prophetic indictment on them circumventing and nullifying the Torah. And he rebuked them. His opening statement was, "You hypocrites." So all in all, this passage is dealing with an oral tradition that doesn't exist in real time, except in the mind of one who follows the oral tradition. And Yeshua came to straighten that out, and this was the place where he did it. This was the event. Not only did he straighten out the ritual purity, moral purity side, but he also went further and addressed not doing things that the commandments are calling you to do. For example, honor your father and mother. Instead, I'm going to hide my money. I'm going to pretend that I'm giving it as a gift to the temple, and then when you're dead, I'll cancel that, and then I'll have that money. It'll be mine. He says, no, that's a moral impurity. and it's wrong, and you need to get it corrected. So he's fulfilling all those things. He's calling the leaders back to a better Torah obedience. He's identifying in one just one example of where they're missing the mark. And then he's dealing with the oral tradition by explaining that it's invalid. But what happens is, in explaining that to them, the people in the crowd do not understand. They're like, what? Is the whole ritual impurity system gone now because he said this? That is a misunderstanding. So that's why he says, I'm calling all the people. Y'all come in a little closer here and listen to what I'm saying and understand that food has been declared by the Most High, it's clean. Eating that food, unless it goes by the definitions in Leviticus where it becomes unclean, but that's not the case here. There's no discussion of unclean here. This is ritual defilement, not unclean. If something happens, there's a short list of things that can happen which would make something unclean, then you have to handle it, and that's in the Torah. That's valid. But unwashed hands does not make the bread unclean. And that is a major difference. All right, so let's keep going. In that verse, he says, listen to me. The food, you can eat it. It's not about the food going in. It's not about what you think about the bread being touched by somebody who doesn't have washed hands and now you've become defiled. No. The problem is the reverse side. And once again, I go back to what I said. Ritual impurity points to moral impurity. It's not what goes in, it's what comes out. And he says that right in the sentence. It's what comes out. So it's not only what comes out when you go to the bathroom, which does, that is a ritual defilement, but it's what comes out of your mouth because of what's in your heart. And you're going to see those verses coming up. He goes into a greater defining of examples so that people can be clear. So in this section, part four, he's brought the people together. And he has said, okay, listen carefully and understand. And in some translations, you'll find where it says, if you have an ear, let him hear. That's not in most of the text, even though it's true. If you have an ear to hear what I'm saying, then you can escape the slumber problem that is in Isaiah 29 that he's prophesying over people who reject Torah. So if you do have an ear, please listen. But it's not in the text, so I'm just mentioning it just so you know in case you have a version that has it in your text. We're going to continue there. I want you to think about what happens now. We're in Matthew 15:15. We have had this stated. Yeshua states it in the first part about the Pharisees, and of course he does go into the father and mother thing. But in the second part, he realizes that there are people there that did not clearly understand what he said. And Yeshua has this problem that goes on. Do you remember with Lazarus? They were going to go visit Lazarus. They got a message that he was sick and they didn't go. And eventually there's a comment and Yeshua responds with, he's sleeping. And you know what the disciples said? Oh, that's really good. He probably could use the rest. And then he goes, no, he's dead. People would not get what he was saying sometimes in his illusionary statements, so he has to sort it out for them. So here we go. He calls the people who overheard this, who clearly didn't understand exactly what he meant, and he said it again. So now you would think it's clear, because these people do know Torah. They do go to synagogue where Moses is. Moses is taught every Sabbath. So of all the people that you would think that would have a grasp on this now be the disciples, but no, that's not the case. If you read Matthew 15, it says, then Peter said unto him, can you explain this to us, please? Yeah. So Yeshua says, are you still not understanding what I'm saying? And then in verse 17 of Matthew 15, he says, do you not understand that whatsoever entereth in at the mouth, when you eat food, where does it go? It goes into your stomach. And then after a period of time, it's cast out into the draught. In other words, it goes through your system and comes out into the sewer system. That's how the human body's designed. Nobody has an exception to that. That's how it works. The things that you eat go into your stomach and eventually are discharged from your body. That is the process. But those things which proceed out of the mouth, they come from the heart. And those things can defile the man. So that is what he is saying as he explains it to the disciples. So look at what he says to make this clear. He says, from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, evil eyes, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. And that's his list. Now look what he says. All these evil things come from within and defile the man. That's the end of the story. So going back again to the beginning, what did I say? What is this teaching about? This teaching is about straightening out an aspect of ritual purity that was out of control. It had gone too far. Do not put the weight of the priests at the temple, eating the sacrifices that are brought to them. Don't put those responsibilities on the people at their house. Don't do it. It's not right. And notwithstanding Romans 14:14, if you got it in your head, then you have to go with what your conscience says. Okay, that's true. But notwithstanding that, why is it that your disciples, some of your disciples, do not honor the tradition of the elders and wash their hands before the meal? Because there is no derived impurity from their hands. It's not in Torah. So as you can see, so far in this text, we are talking about a ritual purity issue that has been expanded beyond what Torah dictates, which makes it a heavy yoke for the people. But Yeshua has straightened out his disciples, and they're not going to do that. So they don't. Then they get called out, and so he straightens out the situation. So all of this has to do with ritual purity, ritual impurity, moral purity, moral impurity, and none of it has to do with changing what the Most High decided was clean and was designated to food. And that's going to be important when we get to the end of this text. But I feel like I need to do one more little piece here so you can understand what is taking place here in relation to the four questions I asked. As far as the Torah and the law of God, what was the primary responsibility of the anointed one that was going to be sent? Do away with the entire law, do away with some of the law, speak the words of God, unravel traditions. Because there's a lot of people who say, well, in saying what he said about ritual purity, he canceled everything. No, that's not what took place. That's what some people want to think took place. That is not what happened. So I want to give you another piece of that that you can consider as we come to the... We're not there yet, but we're coming close to the end here. I want to bring to your attention something that takes place in both stories. I find this quite fascinating. If you were going to go back to Torah and you were going to discuss about keeping the commandments, one of the passages that might pop up would be in Numbers. And this is where they wear tzitzit. Chapter 15, late 30s, there's a discussion about these fringes, tassels, hem of the garment, etc., that hang down from their clothing, and they are instructed to wear these. And why are they instructed to wear them? So that when you see these, you will remember all of the commandments of Yahweh and do them. That's Numbers 15:39. So the wearing of tzitzit was for that reason. You see it, you remember all the commandments, and you do them. So, interesting. One verse, the one verse before Mark chapter 7, verse 1, and the verse right before Matthew 15 and 1, just the last verse of the previous chapter, here's what's interesting. Here's how the story reads. I'm going to read the Mark version. And wherever he went, into the villages, or cities or farms. They laid the sick in the marketplaces and begged him that they might touch even the tzitzit. And all who touched it were healed. Isn't that interesting? Matthew's version is very close. So here's my question. Are these two gospel writers portraying Yeshua as an observant Jew, a Torah observant Jew wearing tzitzit, so that when it is seen, everybody will remember the commandments and do them? Because as soon as that event takes place, chapter 7, verse 1, chapter 15, verse 1, here is Yeshua addressing the oral tradition problem, addressing the moral, what would you say? I could say moral impurity. Addressing the moral impurity problem, then making sure the people understand that what I'm telling you is within the boundary of Torah, that food does not get derived impurity, so therefore eating it doesn't make you ritually impure. So he's straightening that out. But then he does emphasize that there is a moral impurity of the things that come out from within, which he then summarizes in Mark 7:21 and Matthew 15:18 is also in that same time period. He is saying that what comes out can defile you. And this is not the only place that that's mentioned as well. So it seems to me that even in matters of ritual impurity, no, even in matters of ritual such as the adornment of your clothes with the tzitzit, it's about seeing it and keeping the commandments. Does it strike you as askew? The word askew, does it strike you as askew that both gospel writers would include in the story of healing one verse before they start this story about the tzitzit that Yeshua wears, and then we get into the story, and then the Pharisees, the subsect of the Pharisees, are not observing correctly, so he calls them out, calls them hypocrites. And then as soon as he finishes with that, he himself does away with a whole body of laws from the Torah. I leave that with you until our next show. Thank you.